Kids Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Parrott. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a poll shows that voters just aren't convinced that the 2016 presidential candidates would do a good job. We'll look at those numbers and what might be influencing voters.
First, a state representative is proposing a bill that would require votes on a budget item to take place during normal waking hours.
The state legislature has a history of long, sometimes contentious debates that'll end with a vote on an issue while most Wisconsinites are asleep in bed.
For example, the Assembly passed last year's budget in the early hours of Thursday morning after more than 12 hours of debate.
Joining us now is the representative behind the bill that would change this practice, Beth Myers from Bayfield. Representative Myers, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be with you, Rob.
Well, first of all, spell out what would change under this legislation.
I'm looking forward to having conversations during waking hours with my colleagues on the floor so that citizens of the state of Wisconsin can participate in the conversation with us, and so that we have what Wisconsin has been well known for, open and good government happening during the hours that people will be listening to us.
Well, talk us through some of the experiences you've had with late-night budget votes.
Well, this year our budget went late into the night, and even though we did have a bomb threat and that delayed us a couple hours, there were things that we were talking about in the night that people should have been able to listen to. I know that people listen to Wisconsin Public Radio when they're driving in their cars or when they're sitting at home at night, and it just would have been nice if everyone could have participated in those conversations.
Well, the idea is that the budget is a months-long process. It's been picked apart bit by bit over the course of weeks, maybe months. So by the time the vote actually happens, isn't the talking done? Is anything new really happening in that late-night vote?
If we were to take that approach, we'd never have to be on the floor to debate our bills. I think it's important that people understand why we are voting one way or the other for a bill, and that we follow up with the conversation so we can say, okay, I'm against this bill for shoreland zoning, for example, in my district, because Bayfield County and other counties in the district have worked for decades to make sure that they have established zoning procedures that are unique to the area and that meet the needs of the district. So those are conversations that people should be able to listen to.
And would your legislation apply only to budgets or any legislation?
This one is applying only to budget, but maybe we can expand it in the future.
Is this something, it seems like I hear about this every couple of years when the budget's happening. There's always that late night crash session at the end. Why does that keep happening?
I think because when we get to the point of the calendar, the agenda where we're pushing the budget through, we've got so much to take care of, and it's crunch time. But I think there's a better way to do it, and we need to extend how many days we may be on the floor to work on the budget. This is a very important issue in the state of Wisconsin. And again, I don't think I can say too often that government works best when the citizens know what's going on and feel like they have a voice in the process.
Is legislation needed, or is there just some sort of basic civility needed? And we've seen informal agreements, something like this, where the majority party and the minority party negotiate a plan and they just come up with some kind of, hopefully, common sense solution. Is this something that could just be hashed out among legislators without legislation?
It's always great when we can work together without having a law to dictate it. But I think if we did have this bill pass and it becomes a law, that'll just make sure we all continue to follow the rules.
We're talking to Representative Beth Myers from Bayfield. She is proposing new legislation that would put an end to late-night budget sessions, something Wisconsin is well known for over the years. So you're looking for normal waking hours for these budget debates. So what would that mean in legal terms?
I don't know about what it means in legal terms, and I would leave that up to the leadership of both parties to figure out exactly what that means. But typically, anything before 11 p.m.
And we've seen sessions go much, much later than that. Is that right?
Later than that, yes.
Maybe some bills, the budget, there's a deadline usually. Isn't it necessary sometimes to have that all-nighter just to get things done and put it to bed?
Well, I think that makes it, if this bill passes, it will mean that we need to step back, look at our calendars and bump it out a day so that we do finish our business during daylight hours.
As you talk about this with your colleagues in the legislature, what kind of reaction are you getting from people?
I'm getting a good reaction, especially on my side of the aisle, of course. But people understand the need for this, and they understand that if it's the 74th district, which I represent, or any district in the state, citizens want to be involved in the process. And this just, again, makes good, open government.
Is this something you hear from constituents, maybe not specifically the late night issue, but the idea that they're worried about transparency of how things like our budget get passed?
Absolutely. Things happen very fast here in Madison. Right now, as we end the winter session, bills are coming at us at rapid speeds. And hearing a bill will come out, and it's like 24 hours later we're doing a hearing, and very soon after that it's being execed. So I think people want to slow down the process and actually be able to understand what we're doing. Even staff and members of the assembly are going, wait a minute, I didn't have time to read that. I didn't have time to research that particular issue, and now I'm being asked to vote on it.
Is there the perception, maybe the reality, that in these late-night sessions, things get added suddenly under cover of darkness and get passed before anybody knows what's happened?
There is that perception, yes.
Is it a reality, too, do you think?
Yes, I do.
So is this a bipartisan problem? I know Republicans have been in charge of the legislature since 2010, but I remember late-night sessions when Democrats were in charge. Is this something that you see as a partisan issue?
I do, and I hope my colleagues on the other side of the aisle will see that and support this bill.
So what's the timeline on this legislation? Do you have hopes that the Republican majority will pick this up?
I always hope the majority party will pick this up or any of my bills. I'm not sure it will get through this session, but I think it raises awareness of the issue, and if it doesn't get through this session, we'll try again next time.
Representative Myers, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. A pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
That was State Assembly Representative Beth Myers from Bayfield talking about her proposal that would limit voting on budget items to normal waking hours.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
A study from the Pew Research Center says voters are doubtful any of the leading candidates from either party would make a good president.
Also, more voters actually say each would make a terrible president as opposed to a great president.
Joining us now to talk about those numbers and why voters are so skeptical is Lily Gorin. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. Lily, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show again.
So taking a quick look at these numbers for context of those surveyed, 35% of voters said Hillary Clinton would make a greater good president, as opposed to 44, a bigger number, who said she'd be a poor, maybe even a terrible president. And then looking at Donald Trump, who was the front runner at the time of this poll, about a third of those surveyed said he'd make a good or a great president, but nearly half said he'd be a bad or a terrible president. What do these numbers tell you about voters this season?
Well, I sort of was looking at the poll again, and it was taken in early January, and I have a feeling some of these numbers have switched around a bit at this point also. But, you know, it's sort of some of the issues that we've seen all of this campaign season with a lot of skepticism, particularly with regard to somebody like Donald Trump. Some of the skepticism with regard to Hillary Clinton, with people who didn't like Hillary Clinton before, and they still don't like Hillary Clinton, so they are pretty skeptical about whether or not she would be a good or great president. And some of those people, you know, again, not in the Democratic Party, but some of the folks who are big supporters, enthusiasts of Bernie Sanders, who really don't find Clinton appealing at all. And so that's, I think, a lot of what you're seeing in this Pew study is folks in the various parties not liking, I think that's pretty clear from some of the numbers, not liking the candidates at all from the opposite party. And then some skepticism about the candidates that are from their own party.
Well, you said if you had to play out your hunch, you think some of these numbers would have switched around. What do you think might have switched?
Well, you know, again, the issue of Donald Trump this campaign season has been a bit of a wild card. And so I'm wondering about, you know, still if 31% of Republicans or, you know, people who are supporting Donald Trump or considering Donald Trump would think he would be a good or great president. And I'm wondering also about some of the other numbers with regard to Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio now as well, because those were some of the other ones who were surveyed and questioned.
What do you think the narratives are, the factors that might be making voters feel a little bit more apprehensive about this election compared to 2008, for instance?
Well, I mean, I think you also have to distinguish between some of the discussions on either side also, because the discussions in the debates, a lot of the debates on the Republican side, and again, more people have watched the Republican debates and there have been more Republican debates. There's a lot of discussion of anxiety about terrorism and approaches to conducting wars against ISIS. And there's a sort of ratcheting up of a lot of the discussion with regard to threats to the United States. It's much more present with regard to the Republican candidates than the Democratic candidates. On the Democratic side, there's been a lot of discussion, particularly being led by Bernie Sanders, with regard to wage anxiety and economic anxiety. And so you have candidates on either side who are discussing issues, and they're discussing them in ways that are sort of fomenting or sort of augmenting fears and anxieties with regard to policy areas that also the base of the party has some vested interest in or is generally more concerned about.
Is this the kind of poll that you might expect to see early on in the race, where people are sort of, you know, they don't know the candidates that well yet. They don't have a vested interest. They haven't put their chips down. If you polled a little later, these numbers might be a little stronger for the front runners.
I think that you might see some changes, some shifts as the campaigns get going, as the primaries and caucuses are starting to take place in places other than Iowa and New Hampshire, as people are starting to check in more as they see Super Tuesdays approaching. And so then you have multiple states with candidates and campaigns and advertising and more clarity also about the candidates themselves as they see, as voters engage more with the candidates and the campaigns that are being run.
So at this stage, though, as you were talking about the issues involved in the race, ISIS, for instance, the threat of terrorism, do these numbers say more about the narratives and fears of people than they do about the candidates?
I see the numbers where there's, you know, sort of more skepticism on the side of voters with regard to, I think this person would be a good or great president, and they're a little bit more hesitant with regard to that. It's sort of intersecting with some of the anxieties that the campaigns themselves are engaging with. And so you're not necessarily seeing all that much from candidates who are advocating in a sort of positive timber or sort of a happy warrior sort of disposition. There's a lot of discussion and sort of campaign speak about, you know, this is what we have to be concerned about. This is what we have to be afraid of. This is what we're fearful of. And therefore, the policies that come from that. And so when you know, sort of that's the baseline of the campaign dialogue, that also creates anxiety for voters.
I'm curious about that phrase you just used, happy warrior. What does that mean in the context of a political race and what we're not seeing right now?
Well, I mean, I think it's a dispositional issue also. And you see the front runners that are attacking each other. You know, you see somebody like Donald Trump, who's always often attacking the folks who are sort of nipping at his heels. And while he's advocating for policies, the policies that he's advocating for are also with regard to the threat that he is articulating coming to the United States. And again, it's not just Trump, but Trump has sort of taken so much of the oxygen out of the room that pretty much everybody on both sides is sort of in that context. And I don't see Trump necessarily as a kind of happy warrior. I know Scott Walker sort of defined himself in that regard, and the terminology often was applied to Ronald Reagan. But, you know, it's again the sort of the general disposition of the campaign that we've seen in the past from other candidates, and more particularly more recent past from somebody like Barack Obama when he was first running in 08, was a different kind of campaign disposition. It wasn't necessarily about attacks, as more as a sort of a happy warrior. George W. Bush running as a compassionate conservative was more in that vein as well.
We're talking with Lily Gorin right now, professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha, talking about a new Pew survey that seems to show the voters at this point a little skeptical that the front runners would be a good or a great president. And you know, one of the things that's interesting about this poll is that people are more engaged than they were in 2008. So how can people be sort of less enthused about the candidates and also more engaged at the same time?
Well, you're sort of starting out of the gate from the Republican side. We had a total of 17 candidates at one point. And so being engaged is also like, you know, possibly trying to just keep a scorecard. And part of it is, you know, you sort of like, oh, well, who are these 17 people? And do I know them? And do I have an opinion of them? And should I pay attention to all 17? Or now we're down to 9, I think. My students and I were tallying them up yesterday. I mean, the Democrats have had fewer. They had 5 at their sort of height, and now we're down to 2. But it's, you know, sort of some of the issue around engagement is about, you know, who are the candidates and what are they like and what do they stand for and how are they different from each other. And part of what we have seen, particularly going into some of the primaries and caucuses, is on both sides is a little bit more feistiness, a little bit more attacking and negative ads and negative comments about the other candidates. And so there's engagement, but there's also now sort of a big opening that seems to be coming with regard to attacking the other person or the other people in order to sort of distinguish yourself from them.
I imagine political campaigns don't come out of nowhere. They're the product of the political landscape that they're living in. So does that sort of feistiness and negativity that you're talking about, does that just mirror what we're seeing in politics in general, or do you think it is unique to this race?
No, I think it's definitely mirroring the sort of polarization, the acute polarization that we've seen during the pretty much most of the Obama administration, and also the economic anxiety that sort of started that administration in 2008, and that contextualized the election in 2008 and the economic downturn and sort of coming out of the economic downturn. And then we have, you know, again, we have sort of more terrorism. We had terrorism during the Bush administration. And we've had terrorism in a lot of other administrations, but we sort of had sort of 9/11, and then we had some terrorism, the London bombings, and then we've had, you know, sort of this growth of ISIS and some other threats that have now replaced Al Qaeda. And so there's concern with regard to the national security, there's concern with regard to economics, and then there's also the political situation in which we find ourselves every year or two at the brink of a sort of government shutdown, and a lot of attacks with regard to what the government is doing, isn't doing, we should shut it down, why we should shut it down, and so forth.
Well, another one of the narratives that's coming out of this campaign is that this is a familiar one, the Washington outsider territory that people are trying to plant their flag in. Senator Cruz has been hitting that one hard. So has Senator Bernie Sanders trying to do that one as well. What does that mean about what voters want or what the candidates think that voters want?
Well, the Washington outsider has been an interesting sort of argument that you're seeing on both sides, but it was more pronounced and has been more pronounced. Again, you've had multiple candidates who are in that position on the Republican side, because you had at least 3 of the candidates who've never held elected office in Trump, Carson, and Fiorina. And you had, you know, Trump and Carson who were leading the polls for a lot of the summer also. And so you have the people who are actual outsiders, and then you have candidates who are taking on the mantle of being an outsider, like Cruz. And part of the argument that Cruz is making is that he's an outsider because he doesn't compromise and he won't compromise. But again, that's a sort of difficult position to be in when you're talking about the sort of Madisonian system that's predicated on compromise and to some degree political collaboration across party lines and across policy areas. Sanders is you know, positioning himself as well as to some degree an outsider candidate, but again, he's held public office for quite a few years in a variety of kinds of public offices, mayor, as a House member, and now as a senator. And you know, same with Cruz. Cruz was in administrations, and he's a senator, and so he's an insider, but he's an outsider. And so some of it is sort of naming yourself as an outsider, but it's also how you operate. If you're trying to operate outside the system because you refuse to collaborate or compromise, and that also is how people are defining themselves as outsiders.
Well, Lily, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That was Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. She joined us to talk about a new Pew survey that seemed to show voters a little more skeptical about the top candidates this election season.
I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Tuesday is Mardi Gras, the last day before Lent. It's dedicated to living large and eating well before a time of giving things up until Easter. And a lot of people like to embrace the let the good times roll tradition, regardless of their religious beliefs. And a big part of that is the Cajun food of Louisiana.
Joining us now on Food Friday to talk about Cajun cooking is Chef Dave Heide. He's executive chef of Liliana's in Fitchburg, a graduate of Le Cordon Bleu. He's worked at a Michelin-starred restaurant in California, as well as several restaurants in the Madison area. Chef Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. I'm so glad I could be here. Well, and I have one slight correction, though.
Oh, okay.
So Tuesday isn't actually Mardi Gras. Tuesday is Fat Tuesday.
Fat Tuesday.
And then Mardi Gras actually starts on Twelfth Night and then continues. Oh. So Mardi Gras is actually a very long celebration that's about a month long and then ends on Fat Tuesday.
Well, if anyone's going to correct us, it's going to be the Cajun chef. So
exactly.
I take that in hand.
Well, give us a sense of where Cajun cooking comes from. I think Louisiana, I think New Orleans. Tell us a little bit about the origin story of the food we're talking about.
Sure. Well, they're actually two parts. So I think up here in Wisconsin, it gets kind of confused a lot between Cajun and Creole. They kind of get intermixed. Like a lot of times you'll hear, oh, it's a Creole pasta or a Creole something or Cajun, and they're kind of similar. But they actually have two very different backgrounds. The Cajun food actually comes from the word Acadian, and it was the Canadians who came, kind of like the equivalent of the Mayflower was for the U.S. The Acadians came from Canada to flee religious persecution and ended up in New Orleans. And then the Creole was kind of the Creoles were the immigrants that came in, so the Italians and Spanish and whatnot. And then the Cajun was that, and then it was mostly like rural farmers and whatnot. So nowadays, it kind of stems, the Creole is more of the French-influenced food, so you'll see a lot of the roux and the fish, and then the Cajun food is more of the bayou backcountry, less seafood, more like, you know, raccoon and squirrel, which isn't as much up here.
But. And what do you tend to do at your restaurant, Liliana's?
No squirrel or raccoon, but at Liliana's we do, our whole idea is not to be a Cajun restaurant, but like a fine dining restaurant you'd find in New Orleans. So, people ask me all the time, like, why'd you pick New Orleans as your cuisine? And for me, the greatest thing is that it's such a melting pot of different culture and cuisine. You know, there's Spanish, French, Native American, African, Chinese, German. I mean, pretty much since it was one of the oldest trading ports in the U.S., it has such an influence of different cuisines and cultures. You can do anything you want and still be true to the cuisine itself.
Well, given that rich variety of influence there, are there some ingredients that we find again and again in Cajun and Creole cooking?
Yeah, you know, you'll see one of the big issues was there were a lot of people who, again, because people kind of immigrated into New Orleans, there are a lot of people who really didn't know how to cook with the ingredients that were there. And so you have things like, in the South, things like wheat don't grow very well. And in French cooking, roux is used a lot. So a mix of equal fat, flour and fat. But they didn't really have a way to grow wheat and to process that into flour. And so they worked, the Native American showed them that by taking ground sassafras root, you could grind that and that would work as a thickener and it could make some flatbreads that they had at the time. And then that is what is filet powder. So filet powder is the ground sassafras root. And it's one of the reasons why that's used so much in Creole cooking is not only as a flavoring ingredient, but going back throughout history, that was one of the only things they had access to.
And I've heard that there's something called a Cajun Trinity for spices. And all I can remember is something like there's some sort of celery involved.
Yeah. So it's not. So in traditional French cooking, there's what's called mirepoix. And mirepoix is 50% onion, 25% celery, and 25% carrot. Well, carrot doesn't grow in the South. So they take the carrot. Instead of using carrot, they use the Trinity, which is instead of carrots, it uses peppers. So you'd have onions, peppers, and celery, and all of those grow. So like at Liliana's, we have our quinity, which is red pepper, green pepper, onion, celery, and garlic. And that's in 90% of what we make.
So a lot of the recipes will start with, what, sautéing those five things? And, and then you start adding the other stuff.
Well, it's one of the things that's so fun, too, is, you know, you think like, oh, if everything starts with those same basic ingredients that they're all going to taste the same. But it's one of the cool things about Creole cooking is each one of them has their own kind of thing that makes them special and unique. And you can take those same five ingredients and turn them into a plethora of different flavors and tastes. So
what about spices? Is there a spice version of that?
Not of the Trinity. So the spice, so we have like a Creole seasoning that we make in-house at Liliana's, and that's like called Cajun seasoning or blackened seasoning. And that's usually made up of onion. It's like eight spices, but like onion powder, garlic powder, black pepper, oregano, salt, cayenne pepper, paprika. The ones you get at the store are 90% salt and paprika because those are the two cheapest spices. So we make our own in-house, and we just use pretty much an equal ratio of everything except for salt. We use two parts.
It's Food Friday. We're talking Cajun and Creole cooking with Chef Dave Heide from the restaurant Liliana's in Fitchburg. Fat Tuesday just around the corner. Want to get into a recipe you shared with us. We've got this up by now, I think, on the Central Time Facebook page. And I'll say there was a time in my life, Dave, when I dreaded the word jambalaya because I was in a dorm and I was suspicious that things like jambalaya or stir fry were last week's food mixed up and repackaged as something else. So talk us through jambalaya. Make me excited about it. What goes into real jambalaya?
Well, it's actually funny that you mentioned that. All of the really traditional recipes, you know, the things that you think of when you think of Creole food, such as like jambalaya, gumbo, etouffee, red beans, Creole, all of those are the same kind of thing as if I were to ask you for a recipe for what is the recipe for a casserole. Like every single person in Wisconsin would give me a different recipe for casserole because it's all whatever their mom had the most cans of frequently in their pantry or the pasta that they always liked to buy. It's whatever was around. The same thing happened with most of those foods. Most of those foods were done on the riverboats up and down the Mississippi. The people who were working the riverboat would have a big pot in the middle and basically whatever ends and scraps and trimmings they had, they'd put into these big cast iron stock pots and then let them simmer all day. And then about halfway through when they were about ready to take their lunch, about an hour before lunch, they'd dump the rice in there and then cook up basically a big paella that turned into either jambalaya, gumbo, etouffee, one of those traditional dishes. So most of the food that's really popular in New Orleans actually comes from really, really, really poor people. It was the scraps that no one else would eat that kind of chop it up and stew it long enough that eventually it turned into something delicious. So again, at Liliana's, it's different. We don't just take the scraps and leftovers. Ours has tasso ham, andouille sausage, peppers, onions, tomatoes, celery, that whole quinity we talked about before. You'll sometimes also have people. So ours, we use fresh tomatoes in the summer when it's in tomato season, and then we use canned tomatoes in the winter. Sometimes people are like, oh, canned tomatoes, like that's not fresh. But, you know, the reality of it is when you go to a grocery store in February and try and get a tomato, it's more like a potato and they're starchy and gross and no flavor. all the canned tomatoes, when they're harvested, it's at the peak of tomato season. So they're always, you know, ripe and sweet and ready to go. So, you know, it's one of those things, like, when they're in season and fresh, use fresh. And then when they're out of season, definitely don't use those potatoes at the store.
And what is tasso ham? That was the one thing in your list that was new to me.
So tasso ham is a kind of ham that's in New Orleans. It's a smoked and cured ham. And then after it's got a really spicy dry rub on the outside. And then as it's cured, it has kind of like a hot sauce in with the bag as it's cured. So it's kind of a hot sauce marinated, spicy rubbed ham. And there's one local place. There's actually a local tasso ham maker called Delta Dream, and you can get it at Metcalf's. It's a little expensive, but one of the things about a good tasso ham is that a little bit goes a long, long way. And it's absolutely amazing. So, and again, it's a nice local provider of something that's traditionally a Southern dish.
So how labor-intensive is jambalaya? If someone's sort of a novice, they haven't done this before, they're not a chef, and they want to try something like this for Fat Tuesday, how long do they have to invest?
Oh, that's such a good question. Like so many things, the biggest time is the prep and then the waiting. You know, it's not as intensive as like a hollandaise or something like that requires constant attention the entire time. So for jambalaya, it's more about, you know, having something that you can stew and you can prep the veggies ahead of time a day before. And then with any soup, it just keeps getting better and better with age. So, you know, if you want jambalaya for Fat Tuesday, you can get the recipe now and just try it and let it sit in your fridge until Fat Tuesday and it'll just keep getting better and better.
So you call it a soup? It's a soup?
It's a stew, kind of. So, you know, gumbo, jambalaya, etouffee. Etouffee literally means to smother, so it's a gravy. Up here, you know, there are some restaurants which make a great etouffee, but a lot of people think it's really spicy because there are some restaurants here where, you know, the etouffee is so incredibly spicy, but traditionally it's just a seafood gravy. So, but all of them are meant to be served over rice one note, the jambalaya traditionally in New Orleans is a dry jambalaya, which is done kind of like a paella where they make the sauce and then they add rice to it. At Liliana's, we do what's called a wet jambalaya where you have the rice on the bottom and then you put the sauce on top. And that's the recipe that I gave you. If you guys are looking for more of a dry jambalaya, you can add a little bit more water to the jambalaya and then add rice to it as well. So basically the equivalent of how much water to rice you do if you were cooking rice separately, and then you can kind of mix it all together.
And again, for the home cooks, I imagine that jambalaya really holds up well with substitutions. You can use what you have or use what you like instead of something in it.
Absolutely. You know, so we teach cooking classes at Liliana's, and one of the biggest questions we get all the time is, hey, I don't like onions, so what should I do to make my jambalaya? And I'll say, leave out the onions. And it was really tricky. It's really crazy. Or like, man, I just don't like green peppers. Leave out the green peppers.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's one of the great things. You know, it's just like I said before, using casserole as an example. Like if someone tried your tuna casserole and was like, it was good, but I hate tuna, put in chicken, you know? So, or keep it vegetarian or whatever you want to do.
We'll continue our Food Friday conversation with Cajun about Cajun and Creole cooking with Chef Dave Heide. We want to hear from you, by the way. Do you enjoy this kind of cuisine, the Cajun, the Creole foods? Have you been down to Louisiana to try them in person? What did you eat there? And do you make these things at home? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our Food Friday conversation now with Chef Dave Heide. He's an expert on Cajun and Creole cooking and the executive chef of Liliana's in Fitchburg.
And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you celebrate Mardi Gras? And what's going to be on your menu if you're going to cook something up special at home? And if you're going out or ordering in, tell us about your favorite Cajun Creole restaurant in your area. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post a comment or question on the Central Time Facebook page, or reach us by email at talk@wpr.org. And Chef Dave, you were talking about roux, about that being important. This is something I believe in for thickening soups, but why is it so important for Cajun and Creole cooking?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the kind of staples to both etouffee and to gumbo is a roux, R-O-U-X, and it's equal parts of fat to flour. In traditional French cooking, it's done with butter, and in the South, it's done with oil. And one of the key flavor parts to etouffee and a gumbo is the darkening of the roux. So the darker it gets, the less thickening power it has, but the more flavor it puts into the soup. So Like as an example, if you had like New England clam chowder that's done with a white roux or a blonde roux, which is one that's only been cooked for about 2 or 3 minutes. And etouffee is done with what's called a brick roux. And so that's cooking it for like another 15 to 20 minutes. And then a gumbo is made with a brown roux, and that's cooked for about another 20 minutes after that. So, and then you can also, if you want a really rich flavor, you can also do, like for griots, you can do black roux, which is cooking the roux almost to the point where it's burnt, but not quite burnt.
And when we're cooking that roux, is that over a low heat, stirring constantly sort of arrangement?
Yeah, what I recommend is, so there are two ways to do it. You can do either medium-high heat until it starts to really brown and then lower the heat down a bit. Or another thing you can do, which some people think is cheating, but I don't, is you can bake it in the oven at 350 degrees and then just stir it every like 10 minutes. It takes about four times as long, but it's a lot harder to destroy.
But then you can chop your veggies and stuff in the meantime.
Absolutely.
I like that way of doing it.
And you can also, with roux, you don't have to make it that day. So there are lots of restaurants where because that dark brown roux takes so long and it's so meticulous and so much work, they'll make a giant batch of it. Mm-hmm. And then you can store it for later. So you can take that roux and then use it later on in different cooking. So
is it hard to tell when you've got the roux to the right moment? I know when I've overcooked roux, it gets sort of this nutty dark brown flavor. It sounds like you're taking it way beyond that. How do you know when you've hit just the right amount of time or color?
That's a great question. You know, we do cooking classes at Liliana's, and our cooking classes differ from most. Most cooking classes, when you go, it's they give you a recipe and then you make the recipe. And for me, I don't believe in recipes. I think recipes are meant to be treated like a globe and not like a turn by turn Google map. They're meant to give you an idea of where you're supposed to go, not necessarily exactly. So for me, I think it's all about technique and like things like risotto and roux and searing a protein. All of those things, really, to know how to do them right, there is no there's no photo book or there's no, you know, exact amount of time. Like all people say, like, well, exactly how many minutes for a dark brown roux? And there's so many factors, like how hot is your range? How thick is your pan? Like what kind of oil were you using? What kind of flour were you using? I mean, all of those things have some slight impact on the final quality of what you're doing. So I guess for me, it's one of those things where, like, the first time I made risotto, it definitely was not the same risotto that I make now. You know, it was some parts a little overcooked and some parts a little undercooked. And same thing with the first time I made roux. It's all about just kind of seeing it and smelling it. And that nuttiness that you were talking about is exactly what you're looking for in an etouffee. And like for a gumbo, you can take that filet powder that we talked about before and you can fold that in with the dark brown roux right at the very end. And it gets this really smoky, herbal quality that's fantastic.
We're talking Cajun and Creole cooking with Chef Dave Heide from Liliana's Restaurant in Fitchburg. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line. Diane wants to know, she wants to make something for her work's potluck party. What would be a good Cajun Creole recipe, something that's maybe easy to make and transport, something that's easy to serve at an event like that?
Yeah, you know, jambalaya is our number one seller at Liliana's by about fourfold over any other product we have. And so in terms of an overall crowd pleaser, it's great. You know, it doesn't have any, you know, it's tomato based. So anyone who's used to, you know, spaghetti and meatballs will find it palatable. And it's also the most popular, you know, from the song Jambalaya or from any kind of use there. So for me, jambalaya is always the one. And it's also one that you guys have a recipe for. So that works out pretty darn well.
So what if you want a dessert? All I can think of is a king cake, but let's put that aside for a minute. What if you want a good Cajun Creole dessert?
Yeah, so king cake is traditionally done just leading up to Fat Tuesday as the way to kind of celebrate up to Lent. But then after Lent, the only time you'll ever see a king cake is tourist shops and whatnot. So king cake is a pastry that's made with either a light dough or a brioche dough and filled with cream cheese and cinnamon sugar, and then it's iced and then has purple, green, and gold icing on it, and there's usually a baby in there and all that. But my favorite New Orleans dessert is Bananas Foster, because it's so easy and so fun and delicious, and there's fire, and fire is always fun to entertain guests. And that's really simple. It's just equal parts of butter and brown sugar. Melt it in the pan, add in some diced bananas or sliced bananas, and then saute it. And as soon as the sugar starts bubbling, throw in a little bit of rum. And then as soon as that starts bubbling again, you light it on fire and you get a big show.
Wow.
So Jambalaya, it sounds like, is kind of like pad thai at Thai restaurants. Same thing. A lot of people order it. Most popular thing. Say we're at your restaurant or another Cajun Creole restaurant, or we go down to Louisiana. What do we order that's off that beaten path? Something that's a little more adventurous.
You know, for me, my favorite's always gumbo. And the reason is jambalaya is pretty similar no matter where you go. And gumbo is just, like I said, again, using the reference of a casserole up here, it's always different. And, you know, we've had people from New Orleans come to our restaurant and love our gumbo, but we've also had people who say, like, oh, it was never like my mom's. For our jambalaya, you know, it's always a crowd pleaser, but the gumbo, it's always like, oh, well, my mom made it this way and my mom made it that way. And it's all, you know, one of the things that is so important with New Orleans food is that it really is soul food. You know, it's not a fancy, like, you know, plating it with tweezers kind of food. It's made with passion and love. And, you know, I always tell my daughter, you know, the most important ingredient in Creole cooking is love, you know, and it's one of those things where it's one of the things that happened in New Orleans, after Katrina came through, Hurricane Katrina, was that, because kitchens are not always the highest paying thing, they lost a lot of their good chefs. They lost their house. They lost everything. And the people they brought back in, they followed the recipes that they had from before, but they didn't have that soul. They didn't have that, like, I've been tasting this dish for 20 years and I know how to make it. So,
well, Chef Dave, as we wrap up, how are you going to celebrate Mardi Gras and Fat Tuesday coming up here?
Yeah, well, at Liliana's, we have live music all the time at Liliana's, but we've got a great live band, John Vitale and Marilyn Fisher and Ken Keel, all playing guitar, vocals, and bass and doing some live music. We've got a beat of beer on tap all night long, and we've got all of our Creole favorites. And then we also have a Tuesday tasting menu, which we do every Tuesday. And this one will be just a great taste, if you haven't been to New Orleans, a great taste of the traditional New Orleans food. So we've got jambalaya and beignets, and it'll be delicious.
Oh, beignets, say no more. Well, Chef Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks so much for inviting me.
It's been fun. We've been talking to Chef Dave Heidi, executive chef of Liliana's in Fitchburg, which was named for his daughter, who's also here in the studio with us, by the way. He joined us for Food Friday to talk about Cajun cooking. And don't forget, we have a recipe to Chef Dave's jambalaya, at least a version of it. You can get a little fancy with it. You can customize it. Anyway, that's up right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's a big weekend for sports, and the eyes of the world will be on the big contest to see who brings home the prize in the U.S. National Snow Sculpting Competition that's going on right now in Lake Geneva.
That's right. 15 teams of sculptors are hard at work, and according to the rules, they start with a cylinder-shaped block of snow, 8 feet in diameter and 9 feet high. They were scheduled for 3 days of work starting on Wednesday, and the judges get to look at their work and pick a winner tomorrow.
The final sculptures are going to be judged on creativity, technique, and message. I'm not clear on what the message means, but the judges will be, I'm sure. And the winning team gets an invite to an international championship this year. If I read it right, it's in Japan. So they get to travel to Japan to compete with the international snow sculpting experts.
It's kind of amazing, the sense that someone could do that much with a block of snow. I'm lucky if I can pull off a snowman. I like to pull them off, but it's kind of cool that people are doing this. I think they have special tools and everything.
Yeah, and they're teams, and they practice. And I've seen pictures of winners in the past. It's really amazing stuff. And this combines things I'm bad at, dealing with cold and any sort of visual art at all. So I don't think I'd have a shot against these pros. But if you're in the Lake Geneva area, you can check this thing out. They've got didn't put up a link to this, but there's a website. You can track them down there in a park there, and the big judging is tomorrow.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we're going to recap the biggest headlines from around the state this week with our Wisconsin News Roundup. I'm Veronica Vickers.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time.